I think we are wired for sound and ready to go. So can I say welcome to the last in this series of Oh What a Lovely War? Organised by the MacDonald Centre for Theology, Ethics and Public Life. My name is Edmund Newey and I'm sub-dean of Christ Church and a canon at the Cathedral. And on behalf of us all, it's a pleasure to welcome Professor Holger Afflerbach of the University of Leeds to be with us this afternoon. Dr. Afflerbach has been Professor of Central European History at the University of Leeds since 2006. He's written extensively, both in English and in German, publishing most recently Die Kunst der Niederlage, which is a history of capitulation, of surrender, over the whole sweep of human history from the Stone Age to the present. His paper this afternoon will be slightly more restricted in scope than that, you may be glad to hear, and it is entitled If You Do Not Want to See God's Hand in Everything, Even in the Most Unbearable, You Are Lost, Experiencing the First World War Alongside Kaiser Wilhelm II. Would you welcome Professor Afflerbach?
Thank you very much for your kind words. And thank you very much also for the invitation. I'm very honored to speak here in Oxford, and also the first time that I'm in this wonderful college. It is indeed very impressive. The story that I am going to tell you this afternoon was picked because of the nature of the person who invited me, Professor Nigel Bigger, and his title is Regius Professor for Moral and Pastoral Theology. And for that reason, I thought, what can I offer which has something to do with the First World War, where I have some kind of expertise, and which has something to do with Christianity. And in the story which I'm going to tell, indeed, Christianity and mourning and bereavement will play an important role. A few days ago, the recent three-volume history of this First World War, collected volume edited by Jay Winter, was published, and there is an article on mourning by Joy Damusi. He had some interesting figures. He said that in France, lost during the First World War 1.3 million soldiers, approximately. We had 600,000 widows after the First World War. And some historians say that the inner circle of mourners in France, to stay with this example, was 2.5 million. But if we extend the circle of mourners, some historians say 39 million French were mourning, but France had only 40 million inhabitants. So basically, every single Frenchman was affected by losing in the Great War somebody dear. And the question which I will ask, taking an example, I'm speaking about one individual only, not about millions, about only one person. Is mourning, is suffering by losing somebody dear, influencing social behavior, convictions, social habitus? I have also to say that I told this story before, at least in writing, but it is quite well hidden in one of the best hiding places existing in Europe. 1,000 pages thick German book. So I'm pretty confident that nobody ever read that. The story which I have to tell starts actually with an interview in a British newspaper. On the 28th of October 1908, an interview was published by the Daily Telegraph. It was an interview with the German Kaiser, between the British colonel Stuart Worsley, who had several conversations with the Kaiser in 1907, and in 1908 that was published. The Kaiser tried in this interview to win British hearts and minds, albeit he did that in his usual extremely clumsy way. For example, he said, "You English are mad, mad as March hares." So it starts. Then he continued underlining that he was a friend of England, differently from France and Russia, differently from his own people, that he, during the Boer War, even worked out the campaign plan for Great Britain, so that basically Great Britain won the Boer War because Wilhelm II delivered how to do it, and so on and so on and so on. The publication caused some raised eyebrows in Great Britain. People were astonished to read that the Kaiser had designed the campaign of the Boer War, and doubted that, but it caused an enormous rise of indignation in Germany. The German people were deeply tired of the emperor, who was all the time giving strange public speeches, and they wanted that this guy finally shuts up. And they were basically, from the extreme conservatives to the social democrats, they were trying to keep the man silent. The Kaiser was even left alone in this Daily Telegraph affair by his own chancellor. He was alone, he was criticized by everybody, and he was depressed. Here, a picture of how you know the Kaiser, but in October and November 1908, he was not looking like that. He was close to a nervous breakdown. To keep things going, he needed some distraction, and so he went to the hunting estate of his friend, First Max Egon II of Fürstenberg in Donaueschingen in southern Germany. The surrounding of the Kaiser was with him, of course. And they tried to bring his mood up. And so it came that on the 14th of November 1908, the chief of the military cabinet, General von Hülsen-Häseler, tried to cheer him up, to cheer the emperor up, by a performance dressed as a ballerina, dressed in a tutu. Unfortunately, the general could not go on for long. He had a heart attack during his performance and died on the spot, still dressed in his tutu, of course. The story had to be covered up because a year earlier was an Eulenburg scandal about homosexuality at the imperial court, and for that reason, and Hülsen-Häseler was even responsible for the investigations, so basically they had quickly to dress him in his normal dress. But this is not the point. The point is that there was suddenly a vacancy. The chief of the military cabinet was dead, and now they needed a replacement. And 3 days after Hülsen's sudden death, General Moritz von Lünker was appointed as the German title first, Vortragender Generaladjutant und Chef des Militärkabinetts. This means in English, reporting General Adjutant of the Emperor and Chief of the Military Cabinet. Here he is. And General von Lünker is indeed the topic of my talk. And this is also in November 1908 when my story starts. The story about the Kaiser and the chief of the military cabinet during the First World War. But first, who the hell was Lünker? I bet with you that nobody of you ever heard this name before. Am I mistaken? Of course not. It is not common knowledge, and I don't want to pretend that, but I have to give you a short introduction so that you understand where the importance and especially where the habitus of this man may have been. Lünker was a typical Prussian officer, typical also for a Junker family, you know, East Albian nobility. And especially East Albian nobility was prone for military service. I make the example. Lünker was an officer. He was a general. His father was an officer. His grandfather was an officer. His two brothers were, guess, officers. His wife was a daughter of a general. And his three sons became, of course, officers too. So basically, every male member of this family was a soldier, and this for many generations. Lünker was born on the 30th of January, 1853. He had already seen serious action in the war against France in 1870-71. He was cadet by then, and he was nearly killed by a shot in the belly during the Battle of Gravelotte on the 18th of August, 1870. For his bravery, he got the Iron Cross First Class, but was so heavily wounded that they had to send him to Switzerland to recover his health. In Switzerland, nothing reportable happened except that he made a walk on the St. Gotthard, how do you call the St. Gotthard's pathways, with another lieutenant. In the meantime, he was promoted to lieutenant. Another lieutenant whose name you know probably a little bit better. The name of the other lieutenant was Paul von Hindenburg. So basically, Lünker and Hindenburg were kind of buddies. Let me now describe Lünker's advancement from there in a nutshell. He had a very distinctive career, and I want to mention only four things. The first one, he had a distinctive career as a general staff officer and got the training in the academy and then the general staff. He served in highly prestigious guard regiments. He was a commanding officer, commanding all levels, battalion, regiment, and even a division. And he was what they called in Imperial Germany a court general. Court general means he was an adjutant of Crown Prince Frederick, the later Frederick III, who was married with the eldest daughter of Queen Victoria. And he was later on, in the 1890s, the military governor, a kind of military teacher and trainer of Crown Prince Wilhelm, the son of Wilhelm II. Who complained in his memoirs that Lünker was overly critical with him and had rough and harsh manners. So Lünker had, with one word, a strong portfolio of different experiences as a soldier, and this makes it explainable that he was promoted in 1908 to become the new chief of the military cabinet. I have also to mention that all people in the time, from the far right to the far left, opponents and friends alike, always say that Lünker was of a noble character. So they called him a gentleman, a person with high moral standards, albeit maybe with less intellectual power. Okay, now, another question before we can start with the First World War. What the hell is a military cabinet? I know that it is sometimes confusing to speak about the command structures of an army. You know it from the British Army. How is the chief of the Imperial Staff in London linked with the chief of the British Expeditionary Force on the continent, and who has the upper hand, and so on. For that reason, very quickly, how is the command structure in Germany, and what is the role of the chief of the military cabinet? The German structure of the army is, of course, confusing because there is no such thing as an imperial army. We had in Imperial Germany one navy, but four different armies: the Prussian, the Bavarian, the Württembergian, and the Saxonian army. So we had four armies, but to make a long story short, the Prussian army was dominating, and so also the Prussian chief of the military cabinet. in his field. And in this Prussian-German army, we had three key positions. The first one is the chief of staff. The chief of staff is responsible for military operations, and in case of war, he was de facto commander-in-chief of the armed forces. This was normally in the constitution the task of the emperor, but the emperor had transferred it already during the reign of Wilhelm I to the chief of staff. So we have the chief of staff first person. Prussian minister of war was responsible for mobilization, for equipment, for personnel, for drafting, all that. Barracks, everything material, organizing material for the army. And then we had a third office, a third and smallest office, and this was a Prussian military cabinet, a body directly and exclusively responsible to the emperor and to nobody else. And this office was responsible for advancement, for officer promotions, dismissals, and for decorations of officer. Army positions in Imperial Germany were extremely prestigious. And for that reason, because the chief of the military cabinet responsible for army for officer promotion could actually make and destroy careers in a field which really mattered. This guaranteed his influence in peacetime, and some political enemies said even that the chief of the military cabinet was one of the socially most powerful individuals in Imperial Germany. But also in times of war, the chief of the military cabinet was influential because he was responsible for appointing and dismissing of the chief of staff. Of course, in the name of the emperor. And this gave him and the emperor a very strong lever in terms of personal policy. Even if you don't act yourself, you can decide who acts. He was doing this for the military field, and he had two colleagues, one of the civilian cabinet who did this for civilian posts and one for the Navy. Here are the two colleagues. Oh, sorry. This is not yet the right one, but I start immediately with to explain you this one because it shows that during peacetime, the emperor was basically all the time surrounded by Lünker. This here is a photograph which the emperor gave to Lünker on New Year's Eve 1910, Prosit Neujahr 1910. Der drängelnde Moritz, the pressing Moritz. This is Lünker, this is the emperor. And the Moritz von Lünker, as a chief of the military cabinet, was also kind of military secretary of the Kaiser, basically keeping him on track with his schedule. For that reason here, the pressing Moritz, obviously reminding him that His Majesty has to go somewhere else soon. Lünker was, as far as our sources permit, before 1914, more a hawk than a dove. Not afraid of war and maybe to some extent even desiring it. His relation to the emperor was a very strange one. Lünker was a very, very harsh and rough man with harsh manners. And the Kaiser strangely accepted him as such. And the relation between Kaiser and chief of his chief of military cabinet can be maybe compared with the relation between a very severe teacher and a capricious child. And of course, the Kaiser is a capricious child who basically trusts that the teacher has a better insights and is for that reason willing to accept this harsh behavior. Before the outbreak of the war, we do not know too much about Lünker. And everything we know is shadowy, sketchy, third-hand information. This changes with the outbreak of the war, and it may be that we know about Lünker and his inner life more than about any other person living in Germany during the First World War. And the reason is that Lünker wrote every single day of the war a letter to his wife. And these letters survived. Here is an example of one of these letters from July 1914. So we have a total of 962 letters. And it was a heck of a work to read all that. Probably you have difficulties to read that because it is in this old German handwriting. Anyway, I don't want to torture you with that. The letters start on the 21st of July 1914. Lünker was in this moment with the emperor on the annual cruise in Norway. And they were basically debating, is there war? Is there peace? Is there war? Is there peace? You know, basically in the moment when the Austrians were already writing the ultimatum to Serbia. The letters end with Lünker's dismissal at the end of July 1918 and the very last letter from the 3rd of August 1918, which he did not write to his wife, but to Rudolf von Valentini, who was chief of the civilian cabinet, in which Lünker predicted that Germany had to declare defeat soon. The general wrote every day to his wife at home and gave her a genuine and authentic view of his opinion on the war as well as on the Kaiser. And we learn a great deal about the living circumstances, the conversations, the atmosphere, and the hopes in the German headquarters during the war. At the same token, the letters show a man and a family were destroyed by the war. Lünker was with the Kaiser and his fellow cabinet chiefs. Now we come to the two other chiefs. Rudolf von Valentini on the left, civilian cabinet, and Georg Alexander von Müller, an admiral, head of the naval cabinet. And a third individual, Hans von Plessen, commander of the imperial headquarters, during the entire war, at least until end of July 1918, in the surroundings of the Kaiser. In the headquarters, im großen Hauptquartier, the general headquarters, the mobile headquarters, was a huge institution. Around 5,000 men strong, and at its center were the Kaiser and the cabinets and the staff of the cabinets, of course, the general staff, and then protecting troops, communications, and so on, which adds up to more than 5,000 men. The headquarters was mobile. This means that it was changing its location quite frequently. So it was first in Koblenz, then in Luxembourg, then in Charleville-Mézières, northern France, in Pless, in eastern Germany, in Kreuznach, and towards the end of the war, it was in Spa in Belgium. Lünker was at the heart of that. And he was also the heart of military decision-making process because the chief of staff had to come to the emperor every day around noon to give a presentation, normally 1 hour or maybe half an hour, something like that, about the military situation. So Lünker and Plessen were present when the Kaiser got this briefing from the chief of staff about the military situation. This, of course, does not mean that Lünker could basically make big alternative strategic designs. He could only notice and take notice of what the chief of staff was doing, but as a head of the military cabinet, he had one very important function in that. He and the emperor could decide that they did not like the way the chief of staff was handling military operations, and they could theoretically dismiss him. And this happened indeed during the war twice. The first time, this is Moltke the Younger, chief of staff at the outbreak of the First World War, who very quickly proved to be terribly nervous. So basically that you think the guy is out of his mind, that he was really out of control already during the July crisis. And Lünker was already in August 1914 reflecting on replacing him. This was what he did, and he replaced him in September 1914 at the moment when the Marne battle got lost by Erich von Falkenhayn, Lünker's choice. And he kept him against enormous oppositions for 2 years in office, which was also the task of the chief of the military cabinet, to resist opposition and public pressure to remove Falkenhayn. Only in August 1916, after Falkenhayn losing the Battle of Verdun and in the stressing situation with the Somme battle and Brusilov, he decided that Falkenhayn was at the end of his wit, and he replaced Falkenhayn with these two individuals, Hindenburg, his walking buddy from Switzerland in 1871, and Ludendorff. Hindenburg, Ludendorff, the famous duo which took over at the end of August 1916. I could mention also now a lot of other decisions in terms of appointing and dismissal people, but to move forward, you can imagine it is an important position Lünker had, and to say it with a normal and more modern and anachronistic term, I would say Lünker was during the First World War the head, the chief of personnel, or the head of human resources of the German army. And this is his position, and this is also his historical importance. By the way, in the letters which he wrote to his wife, he does not speak much about what he was doing. Professional, we'll say, the reasons for appointing or dismissal of people. He speaks about that only occasionally, and he was somehow bound to discretion. Even when he was writing to his wife, he was not mentioning this kind of business in some lengths. But he was writing about other things. His constant judgments, day by day, on the war, of Germany's chances to win, on the danger to lose the war. By the way, the first time that Lünker thinks the war can be lost is, interestingly, in late summer 1916. Beforehand, he says, maybe we are stuck, but we will not lose. The first time that it pops up that maybe Germany may lose is in late summer 1916. Then his judgments about friends and fools. And I can tell you that he was speaking about nobody as badly and as critical, not even about the enemies like Russians or British or French, but mainly about Austria-Hungary, whom he strongly disliked. We'll say the German ally Austria-Hungary, as well as the German ally Italy, but which changed sides in 1915, got the most critical comments of all. Lünker had, beside his task as a head of personnel of the German army, also his task as Vortragender Generaladjutant. We'll say he was the adjutant of Wilhelm II. And here I show you only two slides which show some of the business the Kaiser and his adjutants were doing during the First World War. Here we see Wilhelm II talking to General von Emmich, who conquered Lüttich. And in the background, you see Lünker here. This man is Lünker. So basically, Wilhelm II was very busy with visiting troops. Here, another one visiting Belo later in the war. And again, Lünker here in the middle while the emperor is here. Let me come to one key question. How did Lünker see the emperor? Because there are basically two questions. One, Lünker in the First World War, the impact of the First World War on the person, about which I will speak in a second. But the first one is, how did Lünker, as a general adjutant and somebody who was all the time around Wilhelm II, how did his fellow cabinet chiefs see the emperor? And then we can make also a long story short. Lünker, of course, was a very conservative man. He was a monarchist, but his feelings of loyalty were more towards the monarchy as an institution than towards Wilhelm II as a person whom he considered kind of disastrous. He thought the Kaiser is lazy, hypochondriacal, and only interested in his personal well-being and in his comfort. And he was saying at some point in his letters that basically Germany had to win the war, not with the Kaiser, but despite this Kaiser, as he said. To give you only one quote of countless quotes from these letters. On the 19th of May 1917, he wrote about Wilhelm II. It is true, unfortunately, that the Kaiser excludes himself from many things and focuses only on his own comfort. But he did that always, also before the war. He is very weak and strong only when fighting for his private interests, especially for a pleasant and undisturbed existence. All this is all too prominent, unfortunately. He is not up to the great task, nor with his nerves, neither with his intellect. End of quote. Lünker's letters shed also some light on the daily life in the German headquarter. Lünker himself called this always a kind of prison life. He speaks about Gefängnisleben, because he said it is a very regular, monotonous way. Basically, every day was scheduled, and all the day they were talking about war and about nothing else. And for him, it was quite hard to be all the time around the Kaiser. But there was something worse than the Kaiser, much worse. His wife. The wife of the Kaiser was the horror of the entire great headquarter. The reason now you can ask, what has the wife of Wilhelm II to do in the headquarters? The reason was Wilhelm II's nerves were completely shot already at the beginning of the war, and he had a kind of nervous breakdown. And so he needed his wife to avoid a complete breakdown. He needed her, and he invited her to stay in the headquarter. And he did that despite that he knew very well that everybody hated him for inviting her. The reason that everybody hated her in the headquarters was, first, women have nothing to do in the headquarters. We also don't have our wives here, so only the emperor does it. It makes a bad impression. But the key point was that the empress was an intellectually limited woman with an enormous appetite to put her fingers in all kinds of affairs. And she basically felt not hindered by her complete lack of expertise to express all the time strong opinions. And you can imagine, if you have a woman like that, and this woman is unfortunately Empress of Germany, it really gets difficult. And not only that, she insisted also that in the evenings there was a normal court life with court procedures. Now imagine that soldiers who normally get up early in the morning, then they have to hang around in the evening until finally the Empress finds the way to her bed and relieves everybody else by departing, what she normally did only shortly before midnight. So basically, when she was there, it was terrible. And it was also terrible already when the Kaiser was there and his wife was at home, because the Kaiser, or he was in a bad mood, and then he was monosyllabic and not speaking, and also killing all kind of conversation. So that conversation immediately died down, whatever the people did. Or what happened more often, he was speaking like a waterfall. You know, he was talking for hours before he finally came to bed. And of course, he was not talking interesting things, but terribly uninteresting things, and things of a banality which was obvious and clear to everybody who had his senses together. So the Kaiser gave every evening a performance in banality. And of course, they did not like that. And for that reason, in 1915, they started to play skat. Is skat a word you understand? Skat is a German card game. I looked even up how it is translated into English. But the translation of skat is skat. It's in Germany, strangely, that because it's in Germany a very, very popular card game. So basically, they were sitting there and playing cards. And this made somehow the evenings more bearable because they did not have to talk. But when the Empress was there, everything was lost. And Lünker described the court life during the war as, one of his letters, as indescribably agonizing. And especially because of the complete lack of sensitivity and empathy by the Kaiser and his wife, because of their complete lack of real understanding of the seriousness of the situation. Lünker could not stand the, he called it, dull court tattle until 11:30, we'll say shortly before midnight. And in summer 1918, he was so fed up that against all etiquette, he walked away from the imperial evenings by himself. Of course, this could not go for long, and as a result of that, he was fired in July 1918. So, of course, I could not go on to give you anecdotes about imperial court life, but I think you have an idea how it probably went. And it is probably also not surprising because Wilhelm II and his erroneous personality are common knowledge. But there is maybe also another dimension in these letters and the information they give us. And one dimension is that actually the mentality and the living circumstances of the upper class in Germany are heavily neglected by research. Because research has a kind of tendency to research the living circumstances of working class women, of the simple soldier at the front line, out of the sympathy for the real victims of the war. And for decades we are doing that, and we know much less about the real circumstances, living circumstances of the upper classes and the mentality of the upper classes during the war. I think when Gary Sheffield spoke here 2 weeks ago, it was also this lions led by donkeys, and in Germany we have a very similar phenomenon, even if it has another headline. You know, basically you take the view of the lower classes automatically. And what the upper classes did, you see through the glasses of the lower classes of the time. But my statement would be the war was a nightmare also for the upper classes. It was not that they were sitting in a chateau and drinking champagne, and even so, that this would not have helped. The letters which Lünker wrote to his wife, and here I have to mention that these letters are a fragment because we have not a single letter from his wife. After the war, they conserved only his letters, obviously, and threw hers away. I don't know where they are. They are gone. But in his letters, it becomes pretty clear how grim the situation was. Especially in the second half of the war, Lünker sends food to his family. But you know, in 1915, he sends pheasants and hares. But in 1918, he sends boxes with dry rolls. And he took every day from the imperial table one or two apples. You know, basically a four-star general, and Lünker was four-star general, took apples from the table in his pocket to send them then home to his family, which shows you how catastrophic the situation even for high-ranking individuals of the surrounding of the Kaiser Wars. Lünker was also a patriot. He told his wife to buy war bonds and to give gold for these collections of gold wherever possible, even golden watches of his father. But the real nightmare is not that one, and now I'm coming to the heart of my presentation. The real nightmare was not the material hardship, which was still bearable before the war ended. They got along. But the war destroyed Lünker's life. And he was not ready to question his soldierly habitus despite the war destroying his life. What I try you now to explain is like a man who puts one hand in a meat grinder and with the other hand he uses the handle of the meat grinder and does this religiously up to the end. Lünker had six children, I think I mentioned this before, and three of them were boys. And two of them were old enough that they were soldiers already before 1914. The third one was drafted only in 1918. It happened what had to happen. In September 1914, his first son died. He was severely wounded. He was transported back to a hospital, but he died in the hospital in Kassel. Lünker was heartbroken, and he wrote on the 11th of September 1914, exactly during the Marne battle, by the way, I quote, "We knew that it will be a war of annihilation. We knew that before it broke out, but the individual tends to believe that he and his family will be spared. I believed the same, and now we are hit so hard," end of quote. Lünker did not find any consolation, will say the head of personnel of the German army, the guy who was responsible for the promotion and decoration for tens of thousands of officers, did not find any consolation in the fact that his son died for the fatherland. He said this openly. "I know he died for a great cause, but it does not give me any consolation." This hard and rough general, as he was, basically could not sleep. He needed sleeping pills. When he got up from the imperial table in the evening, he went crying to his apartment. He basically, before he could go to sleep, he cried. And this was a kind of constant condition. It was so bad that even Turkish delegates in the German headquarters gave him a decoration, a Turkish decoration for people who lost loved ones in the war. So basically it was common knowledge that Lünker suffered. But Lünker suffered in September 1914 because he lost one son. The second son, Bodo von Lünker, was one of these diehards who always look as a soldier for the most dangerous task available. The Kaiser saw how Lünker was suffering by the loss of his first son and said, why don't you put your second son in a safe staff position somewhere in the hinterland? Lünker rejected this. He said, this is a question of fairness. I cannot use the privileges of my position to protect my family, and my son does not want that. And what did the son want? He wanted, of course, to become a pilot. So he did. And of course, he was shot down. In February 1917, also the second son died. Lünker said, when he learned about the death of his second son, I'm done. Ich bin fertig. This means my life is over. At least everything which is connected with happiness is completely out. This is irreparable. My life is irreparably derailed. He basically says, now I'm hanging along until I die. So he was destroyed, and it is not a word. This man was destroyed. His life and his happiness were gone. And this did not leave him a single moment of the war. But the decisive question is now, what did he do? Because I said, this man is like somebody who puts his hand in a meat grinder and with the other hand is moving the handle. So the grief of the loss of his sons is putting the hand in the meat grinder, but he continued to function as a chief of the military cabinet of one of the three top positions of the German army. Where are the consequences he tried to draw? And the answer is none. There were no consequences, at least none, no consequences I could see in this exchange of letters with his wife. He was too deeply rooted in his habitus as a soldier to declare, for example, the reason for my miserable fate, for the destruction of my life and happiness, is the war of my soldierly existence. No. Of course, he hoped very strongly so in 1918, really impatiently, that the war will end soon, but not for every price. For example, he says that Belgium has to become a German property and or German controlled. He said that the war should not be brokered by social democratic movements, but by the Kaiser, and so on. He had a lot of conditions. All of these conditions were, of course, prolonging the war, and he knew it. He said that. But, and now the crucial point, political reasoning was anyway not what Lünker's forte, not at all. He saw the reason of his misery, and he tried to find consolation in God. This was basically what kept him going. He saw the reasons of his loss not in the war, because probably you agree, most of us would say the reason that he lost the two sons was there was a war ongoing, and it is a kind of political decision-making process which made this war happen, and so it is also political decision-making to make it stop. Instead of that, he saw it completely on a religious and individual level. And the questions he is asking about his misery is, have we been too proud of our sons? Have we been too proud of our happy family life? Is that the punishment for our hubris? Why is our Lord testing us? Why is our Lord testing us so hard? May our Lord give us mercy and save our third son. This is basically what he is asking. He is not asking with a single word, is it my soldierly existence which made that? Can I expect when I am a soldier, my brother is a soldier, and my two sons are soldiers, that we get unharmed out of it? He is not asking that at all. And here I'm coming to a very interesting letter, which he wrote in 1970 to his wife. Actually, obviously, getting a letter from his brother, Kurt. Kurt, Lieutenant Colonel in the Guards, who wrote him a letter and he forwarded it to his wife. I quote now from his letter. I sent you here a very bitter letter from Kurt. And I do not need to add that I disagree with him. If you do not want to see God's hand in everything, even in the most unbearable, you are lost. End of quote. Now, what did Kurt write in his letter? I can only guess what he wrote, but probably he wrote something along the lines, the war is man-made, the war is a senseless massacre, your children died for nothing. Something along these lines. And Lünker, when he said, if you don't see even in this most unbearable the hands of God, you are lost, shows the role Christian belief had for this man to keep on going. And I think here we have also one of the keys of the endurance of people during the First World War. Sure, there will be these callous generals who were with a cynical smile in front of the map table, unaffected by the death of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. And in the German case, I would say Erich von Falkenhayn was probably this kind of general. Or Konrad von Hötzendorf, the Austrian chief of staff, was another example. Or there were fanatical nationalists like Ludendorff. But there was a certain third group in the German case, like Lünker, where Christian belief, the belief in a kind of predestination, an unpolitical approach, and social conservatism are somehow a unity which is very difficult to divide. And the reconstruction of this mentality is important to understand some of the political, religious and cultural preconditions of the First World War. Thank you very much for your patience.